the invitation is not just how do we clear our mind and see our imprints, but it's also what are we nourishing our minds with? So bringing in the wisdom piece. And I think that's so fascinating in our society. You know, we glorify the famous and the beautiful and the powerful and the wealthy. Who cares? Like, do these people have anything valuable to share with us? And the wise people, do we glorify them? We don't even know who they are, where to find them. And yet there's a treasure trove of wisdom across all cultures, philosophies, religions, that's ancient, and that we, in every country, there's a treasure trove of wisdom out there. And I think it's time that we start to glamorize that, because at the end of our life, how will we want to have lived, you know, spending all of our life looking at handbags on Instagram, or having conditioned our mind with wisdom that has helped us to live the life we actually wanted to live, and to sail through it in the difficult times, and to be present with the beautiful moments in our life, like the ones you spend with your child in your backyard.
There is a deep conversation that can awaken our potential and stir our soul. A conversation that explores the possibility of living and loving as fully as we can. A possibility that begins with the practice of opening to life as we move through fear and make the conscious choice to pursue what matters most from a place of courage, wisdom, and love. I'm Joshua Steinfeld, and this is the Courageous Life Podcast. There is an internal flame that lifts us up from rock bottom and keeps us moving through the darkest of nights. There's a roar of defiance that helps us back to our feet every time we're knocked down. And there is an internal freedom and a relationship with yourself so profoundly life supportive and energizing that you access your fullest potential, the fullest potential you were born for. This is sovereignty. And these words come from Dr. Emma Seppala, written in her beautiful and empowering new book, Sovereign: Reclaim Your Freedom, Energy, and Power in a Time of Distraction, Uncertainty, and Chaos. As we began our conversation, I asked Emma to share a definition for sovereign, and she offered a beautiful and simple way to capture the meaning of this extraordinary human capacity. Sovereign is how to be resilient regardless of the chaos that life brings, and how to stay true to yourself and intentional regardless of outside influences. Sovereignty is our birthright. It's what we can all have if we know how. Today, we unpack how, as Emma and I take a deep dive into human potential and our innate capacity for sovereignty. Being in conversation with Emma was profound and inspiring, as she shared moving stories about people she's come across in her life who have found sovereignty in the face of immense challenges and adversities, and what she's learned from them about resilience, inner freedom, and personal power. And while these stories hold the potential to be deeply inspiring, one of them may also be triggering for some listeners, as it's a story of suffering, trauma, and overcoming. Emma will offer a warning before she shares it, which is about 5 minutes or so into the conversation. So please listen in a way that is most supportive for you. Emma will also share some of her own story about a brush with death and finding sovereignty as a result. Together, we'll take a deep dive into what keeps us from experiencing sovereignty, what Emma calls the bound state, and the different forms that this can take in our lives. Why finding sovereignty is really an act of reclaiming our innate strength and wisdom that is there from the time we're young children. Emma and I will explore foundational qualities for sovereignty, including having a caring relationship with yourself, cultivating awareness, and choosing courage. We'll explore practices that can support sovereignty, like meditation, breathing, and reflecting on our relationship triggers. And Emma will generously share some of her expertise and experiences in working with leaders and organizations as we discuss sovereignty at work, particularly how leaders can foster cultures that support being sovereign and how doing so can drive innovation and creativity. Toward the end of our time together, Emma and I will dive into the topic of intuition, of listening to your gut, and having the courage to follow your heart. Personally, this was a particularly moving part of the episode, as Emma brings in some incredible stories about intuition and pairs them with key insights coming out of the neuroscience of intuition. I can say that without a doubt, this was one of my favorite conversations on the podcast, as well as one of my favorite books I've read in recent memory, as Emma shines a light so beautifully on what is possible and offers up practices and a roadmap for how to reclaim our sovereignty. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. And if you want to really dig into this topic, I would highly encourage you to pre-order a copy of Emma's new book, Sovereign, or pick it up when it comes out on April 23rd. You can find everything you need to know about the book, including some wonderful resources that Emma has generously put together at iamsov.com. That's iamsov.com. Now, I recognize that some of you may need no introduction, but if this is the first time that you're being introduced to Emma's work, here are just a few highlights from her incredible career. Dr. Emma Seppala is a best-selling author, a Yale lecturer, and an international keynote speaker. She teaches executives at the Yale School of Management and is faculty director of the Yale School of Management's Women's Leadership Program. A psychologist and research scientist by training, her expertise is the science of happiness, emotional intelligence, and social connection. Her best-selling book, The Happiness Track, has been translated into dozens of languages. Emma is also the science director of Stanford University's Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education. For more, please check out emmaseppala.com. All right, I think that's about enough of an intro from me. Without any further ado, please enjoy this conversation with Emma Seppala. Okay. Well, Emma, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Josh. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's such a pleasure to have you on. I've been a big fan of your work, I think, for quite some time, number of years. And this new book that's going to be released the third week of April, I believe it's the 23rd of April, and we're just recording about a month before that, is called Sovereign: Reclaim Your Freedom, Energy, and Power in a Time of Distraction, Uncertainty, and Chaos. Talk about good timing. I feel like this is really needed right now. And after reading it, as I've said other places, you know, this is a phenomenal book. I read a lot for the podcast, and this book made me laugh like hard out loud a few times, which was just kind of a rarity in my experience. And so that was really welcome. And you write with such grace and wisdom and practicality, and you bring in research, and it's just, I love the poetry in there. It's beautifully done. So congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much, Josh. That's everything I was hoping for the book. So I'm so grateful.
Yeah, absolutely. So I always start, since this is the Courageous Life podcast, with a question, an invitation really to share some of your story. And the question has to do with an adversity or challenge that you faced. And it could be really anywhere in your life. Could be childhood, could be college, the start of your career, wherever it is, that sort of influenced your trajectory or put you on your path in some way, largely of what you're doing professionally today. So what I thought I'd do, though, is kind of take that question and actually pull out a passage from the book that talks about one of these points for you and then invite you to share. So if you'll indulge me, I'll just read a quick passage.
Thank you.
From the book. Yeah. So you write, "The Vermont trip set me on a trajectory to seek inner sovereignty. It's why I went into psychology,
why I was drawn to elderly people in China and Tibet who seem mentally emancipated despite hard lives, why I completed a master's in Indo-Tibetan Buddhism, why I conducted research on the benefits of breathing, why I've meditated for 20 years and regularly attend silent meditation retreats, and why I continue to immerse myself in wisdom. And all these paths have allowed me to re-access and cultivate the state of freedom I was once in for 24 hours on that fateful day. So could you tell me more or tell us more about that fateful day and what you experienced, what that state was like?
So we had just had a car accident with a friend of mine, and who's actually a really remarkable person. She's just amazing. And I talk about it in other parts of the book, but we had this car accident, and the next day we were in college, you know, just being college students at exam time, but all the stress that is usually there, especially at Yale, just high stress all the time, exam time or not. And it just wasn't there. It was completely gone. And we were in this state of blissful gratitude and inner peace, as if, you know, almost like you're watching a movie and you're looking in on it, but you're not of it. And you can see it for what it is and understand what's important and what really doesn't matter. And we were in that, you know, you could think of it as detached, but I don't like the word detached because it's cold. Maybe the right word is sort of observant or aware. Aware in gratitude and in wisdom, in the sense that we weren't caught in the small stuff at that moment. We were just so grateful to be alive. And I think, why aren't we always like that, you know? But we forget, you know, we get caught up, of course, in things. And yet it's those life and death moments when we almost lost our lives that we could really realize, wow. Or the other moments too, I think, when baby's just born or somebody passes away. Like, there are these moments in life where we remember how amazing it is to be here and how short-lived it all is, and become wise in that moment.
That's so beautiful. I mean, I look at kind of this, the word sovereign, and there's these elements that come out in the book again and again about inner freedom and kind of stepping into this sense of personal power. I think what you're describing there seems to me like a real freedom internally from so
total
much.
Freedom. Yeah.
Could you elaborate on sovereign a little bit and what you mean by that?
The way that I can define sovereign in one sentence is how to be resilient regardless of the chaos that life brings, and how to stay true to yourself and intentional regardless of outside influences. So how to be resilient regardless of the chaos that life brings, and how to stay true to yourself and intentional regardless of outside influences. And I think I saw sovereignty in certain individuals that I met in my life over the course of my life. And it really hit me at one point, this is sovereignty. And that is, it's our birthright. It's what we can all have if we know how. I'll give you the example. This story can be triggering for some people, but the story of suffering, I do include in my intro, having met this veteran, a woman who had been in Iraq, and she had had to leave her baby here while she was in Iraq for a year. And while she was there, not only was she in combat during the day, which was, of course, very traumatic in itself, but also her own supervisor prostituted her every night. And if you could just imagine the horror of that. And it was just, when I was listening to her story, I was just, had tears rolling down my face. She's just 24 years old. And she wanted to come back to her baby. And she knew that that was the condition, that if she wanted to come back, she had to do what was told to her. And when I met her and she shared her story, there was no ounce of self-pity about her. She was just like, I just want to be a good mother, good person. And she was in one of our studies, and actually she was in one of the breathing studies we did with for veterans with trauma. And she said that, you know, thanks to being in that study, she felt like she would otherwise have been on the street alcoholic. And she's now a leader in one of the major tech companies in this country. And what I saw in her was sovereignty, you know, it was like, despite what she'd been through, and she had grown up in poverty already. I mean, she was proud of herself for having made it to the National Guard and then having to go through what she went through. And yet she continued to wear her crown in a way. You know, she held on to that, being true to herself, being true to her values, being true to what she was going to do and doing it. And, you know, I think there have been words thrown around like grit and things like that. And that's all well and good, but it's not just that. It's not just pushing through. It's really honoring yourself and being true to yourself in the process. I think that's a differentiating factor. A lot of people out there being gritty, and yet often also falling for behaviors, thought patterns that are not healthy. You know, so that's just one example. So yeah, I mean, I feel like life just presents us with the uncertainty and the chaos and the challenges. And how can we weather that in a way that's both resilient and true to ourselves? And there's science to back up how we can do that. But it does require being aware and courageous, which is, I know what you talk about, that courage needs to be there, but also the awareness. And that's what, you know, I tried to build out in the book, how to do that. You know, we live in a time when there's so much technology, and it's how many people are addicted to it, whether they realize it or not, you know, and similarly with the children and seeing what's happening with them. If we're aware and we see what's happening, then we can extricate ourselves. If we just play right along and fall into the skillfully crafted technology that's meant to get us addicted, for example, we're bound to it, right? And not sovereign.
Yeah. You know, there's a few things. I mean, first of all, before anything else, I just want to acknowledge this story that you just shared and just how hurtful it is to even hear that somebody went through what this woman went. It's just awful. It's terrible. And pulling out of that, her strength, her ability to stay true to herself, her resilience pushing forward is at the same time remarkable, extraordinary. And that story is in the book. And there are stories like that about this kind of inner freedom and staying true to yourself and being aware and being courageous. And I want to thank you for highlighting some of these stories. I think they're extraordinary. So that's kind of one piece. I too want to talk about this idea, this word you use in the title of the book, reclaim. And you talk about coming home to ourselves. I think about this like staying true to ourselves. Is this for you finding sovereignty or being more sovereign? I don't know what the right language is there, being more sovereign in our lives. Is it something that you see that we have initially, just innately? You used the word birthright earlier. So I'm wondering, is this something we see in children and then we sort of get conditioned out of, and then the practice is really reclaiming what's already innately there? I'd love your thoughts on that or anything you'd like to share on that.
Thank you, Josh, you know, for so deeply studying the book, because yes, that word reclaim was very clear. That had to be in the title. I was like, it has to be reclaimed, because it is something we were born with, and it is something that's always there, but that we can lose track of in the sort of the programming of our lives, you know. And I'm not just talking about technology. I'm talking about, you know, sometimes it's specific beliefs that we carry that crush us, and we don't even know it. For one example, whenever I talk to audiences and ask them, are you self-critical? I would say 90 or 95% of the room raises their hand. And self-criticism, if you look at it from a psychological perspective, is a form of self-loathing. Self-loathing. You know, it's different from self-awareness, right? Self-awareness is, okay, you know what? I'm not great at math, right? But self-criticism is beating yourself up every time you make a mistake. And you know, whenever I ask groups like, okay, so what did you say to yourself last time you made a terrible mistake? It's usually, oh, you're such an idiot, da, 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 like those kinds of words. In fact, during the pandemic, when everything was conducted on Zoom, whenever I'd ask that question, people would write what they would say to themselves in the chat. And it was so heartbreaking to read the list. And I would look at that list and say, wow, this is how the human being tears him or herself down. What about that makes sense? It doesn't make sense to have a toxic relationship with yourself. You know, people complain about toxic workplace, toxic romantic relationship. Look at the relationship that you have with yourself. In what way does that make sense? And that's one example of just how we can carry a belief, and it can be passed on generationally from your parents and their parents and so forth, that is harming us. And we know, Josh, you and I know the research on self-criticism and how it leads to greater anxiety, depression, fear of failure, less willingness to try again, basically less resilience. And when you think about the words that you would use for a friend who made a mistake as opposed to yourself, it's always, you'll be fine. Everyone makes mistakes. You've got this. You've learned something. It's all good. You know, why the difference? Why the difference in a relationship with oneself versus a relationship with someone else? There's no difference except that you live in different bodies, right?
Right.
So right. Just one example, and yet it permeates. How many people, you know, at work, like, oh, I'm not good enough for this. I feel like an imposter and go home. Oh, I'm not a good enough parent. Oh, here and there. And it continues. It's destructive. So that's just, you know, one example of a belief that we could have caught on that a child doesn't have yet, right?
Yes, right.
Doesn't have right. yet, but it can be programmed in early. Having awareness of that, it's like, oh yeah, this makes zero sense. Like, I don't need this. And then learning to deprogram that, which of course it takes a little bit of work because when you've been carrying around something for 20, 30, 40 years, but awareness is the first step. And then there are different procedures you can take to start to reclaim your mind, reclaim your relationship with yourself, reclaim how you handle your emotions, reclaim how you listen to your inner voice and so forth.
So I want to continue on this thread of awareness, kind of noticing, becoming aware of the ways in which we're bound, using your language in the book. And I'd love to introduce a question or share a question with you that I've been exploring as a central question on the show for years with many guests. I think it ties beautifully to your work. So in 2018, I sat down with Mark Nepo, and you might know that name. He's a poet and a spiritual teacher. And he posed a question during our conversation together that from his view is one of the most important questions we might ask ourselves in our life. And it's not a question with a simple answer. It's a question that can act or serve really as a companion on our journey through life that we can carry with us and allow the answers to evolve and change and emerge over time. The question was, when my heart begins to close, how do I open it again? Or how do I keep it open? And over time, this has evolved beyond just the physical heart into a conversation with so many thought leaders, people like yourself from many different disciplines, talking about how do we meet life from a place of responsiveness, choice, love versus fear, reactivity, these types of qualities. So this has been a larger conversation on the show and bringing in a past guest, and you address this in your book too. How do we begin to do this? Is the practical question. And one of the responses was, the first step is noticing when the heart closes or begins to close. Like just becoming aware of that. And you begin in the book with, notice the ways in which we're bound, essentially. The ways in which we are not sovereign, not free, so on and so forth. So could we explore some of the ways in which we might be bound? And maybe I'll just pull out one you shared already, because I notice this in myself, like my own addiction to technology and just the ways in which I close down, like I crave it or I want to check it or I become more distracted or I have intrusive thoughts of got to check my email or whatever it is in the midst of a project. Like there's so much happening there. And you talk about there is a path to sovereignty when it comes to tech, which I found so inspiring and practical. So how do you initially react to some of that?
I think we live in a time, it's unprecedented. Like we've never had this much technological temptation that is designed by some of the most intelligent people on the planet to be addictive, right? And we don't have a past history of it. We don't have anyone to guide us. We're frontiers people in a sense, but we're also guinea pigs, right? So, I mean, some of us are lucky enough to remember a time when there wasn't this. I know I am because email was kind of new when I was 18 and it was considered a little weird. So there's a memory of a time when it wasn't like this. But now what I do is I go on silent meditation retreats every 2 or 3 months. There are 3 days online, like easy. I do it with Art of Living. I've always done it with them. And during that time, you're doing these guided meditations. You're offline. You're online. You're on Zoom maybe, or you're in person, but you don't have your phone, nothing. And I always, those moments are such reminders of, oh, right. This is me. These are my thoughts. These are my dreams. This is my inner peace, or this is my emotion that I'm processing, whatever it is. On the last day, and when it's about to end, I always have this vision. Oh, my mind is so clear right now and so focused on what I feel is important. And then I can feel this cloud of the technology and everything I'm going to need to engage with, just like a gray cloud in the sky, you know, like I have to re-engage. But I have those moments of sovereignty and my mind is sovereign during that time. And therefore, I have the space to be aware of what the technology is and how I want to relate to it. And I found that to be a really good exercise. So those periods of silence and complete connection with your own self, which you can also, you know, if you don't do a meditation retreat, you can also even have a, if you have a weekend with just your kids and your family. Things are so simple, especially when you have little children, right? Things are simple. They're in the present moment. You're just playing, doing meals, you know, figuring out whatever. And how much peace comes into the mind during those moments. And we know, you know, from all the Buddhist teachers and Vedic teachers and so forth, always talking about happiness is in the present mind. And we know from research too, that that is, we are never happier than when our mind is in the present moment. We know that. And that's exactly often what technology pulls us out of. So can we be more intentional with it? For example, oh, my phone is off before I have breakfast, you know, before I meditate and have breakfast, whatever you do in the morning, right? Or it's off after 7:30. I have sovereign evenings, sovereign mornings. Those are just some examples of things where you have space for your own mind to be itself and to make its own choices.
You know, it's really interesting because you shared some of these personal experiences in the book, which I just so appreciated. I'll just share one of my own. I've found social media to be so addictive. And I was working through this actually using mindfulness practice of how do I have a more kind of values aligned or healthy relationship with technology that supports who I want to be in the world, how I want to show up, these types of things. And over time, I was becoming increasingly kind of disenchanted with the impact of social media on my own experience, mm-hmm. not speaking for anyone else, but just my own. And eventually, I took social media off my phone. I tried that for a while. That worked to some degree. Eventually, I just got off of most social media. And I noticed that as I disengaged or when I left over time, there was such a freedom and a mm-hmm. peace that came. And you described in your book, and maybe you could elaborate on your own experience mm-hmm. if you're willing to here, the shift when you took email off your phone. Mm-hmm. I think you noticed something kind of similar there. Could you describe a little more about that?
So I took social media off my phone first. You know, someone was helping me schedule. It was all my own content, but they were scheduling and I wasn't really engaging with it. And it was off my phone and that freed up some nice mind space and brought me real much more into the present. And then I took email off because I thought, you know, if there's an emergency, people can text or call me. I can get on my computer and check my email once or mm-hmm. twice a day or whenever, you know, I'm on my computer. And then, yeah, I teach leaders at the School of Management at Yale. And I can't tell you how many CEOs I know who do the same thing. These are CEOs who are leading companies, but they know that that's smart because they're going to be able to be more present and focus on what they're meant to be doing with their time. And then like, look, if there's an emergency, they call me or text me, right? You know, constantly being able to check is constantly checking you out of your life. I mean, for some of us, we have to do it professionally, right? To spread the word about what we're doing.
Sure.
And yet there's a way to do it maybe on a different phone that you don't carry around with you all the time, burner phone, whatever you want to call it.
Right. Are there any, since you mentioned, you know, your work at Yale and working with leaders and organizations, I'm curious if I wanted to create more of this type of culture where it's more focused, I'm more present with my work. I think, and maybe you could speak to this too, there's a link here between innovation and creativity,
yeah,
right? And not being so distracted. So if I wanted to create that type of culture as a leader of an organization, are there certain practices that you think about in terms of our relationship with technology?
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, my favorite thing is whenever I am unplugged or whenever I go, you know, do some yoga, breathing, meditation, or go for a walk around the block without my phone or anything, that's when I get all of my ideas. You know, people ask me, where'd you get all your ideas? I'm like, they just arise in those moments. You know, you can think about it. And I have, you know, that whole chapter on intuition and the research showing that we're wired for intuition and there's neuroscience now showing that it can help us make better decisions. But when do we get access to that? It's when our brain is in alpha wave mode. We're not highly focused on anything. We're not also so lethargic, we're about to go to sleep. It's that sweet spot in the middle. You could think of as a meditative frame of mind. And that is when we have our sovereignty in the sense of the ability to capture thoughts that are full of innovation, that are full of insight. And yet, as we remain trapped in technology, constant stimulation, constantly absorbing things, looking at things, we are robbing ourselves of our creative potential. And we're doing the same to kids. So kids are the most creative beings on the planet. And once you put that kid on a screen and you keep him on the screen, we're robbing them of their constant creative potential, which is what a child is. Give them a box, they're going to create a castle out of it. That's what they do. Yeah. But as adults, the same. So as leaders, I mean, I'm always sharing this research with leaders saying, look, you want people to be innovative. Well, first of all, you need to make them feel safe. Okay, that's a priority. If we don't, that's our first need, right? But after feeling safe, being able to have those moments where they are in a space of well-being and where they're not in this highly stressed or highly focused mode even. Putting in those rules like, okay, no email in the evening. No, like, I want you to take your vacations. I would take all of day, every vacation. And I want you to not check your email on it. You know, most people don't do either of those things, but that is how we get in touch with our innovative genius, which everybody has, if they make the space for that.
Yeah, it resonates so much in my experience. I watch my 3-year-old, you know, just outside playing at the park or just outside in the backyard. And her creativity is just, it's like remarkable.
It is.
What she comes up with and just the game she develops and how she sees things, it's just there. It's there. And it was so troubling to read in the book that stat you shared of, and you can correct this if it's wrong, but I think you said like there's some studies that show that 85% of children are less creative. Or if you look at population of children, there's declines in creativity, like 85% of children are less creative.
Yeah.
That's striking in not a great way.
Like, I mean, do you see how this is what I call the bound state? Because if you put all humans in a situation where they're not accessing their ability to come up with innovative insights, you are seriously curbing the potential of these human beings. And doing it to children, basically robbing them of their ability to, you know, this, look, let's face it, this planet needs a lot of help. And our children have the potential to help it. We need to make sure that they have access to their ability to innovate and to think creatively. And then the other thing is when you're constantly hooked on technologies, what are the messages you're taking in? You are what you eat is the same thing about your mind. What you put in your mind, that's what's going to be in there. That's what you're going to think about. That's what you're going to do. So if you're constantly absorbing messages about how you should look or what you should buy or what you should do, it's programming the mind and being really aware, what am I taking in? You know, I had a colleague at Yale who was like insomniac and he's like, I can't sleep. I was like, well, what's your bedtime routine like? He's like, I watched 11 p.m. news. Well, we know that research shows that the thing you're going to remember the most is the thing you do right before bed. So what are you going to do before bed? Watch the sad and the scary? Of course he can't sleep. His sympathetic nervous system gets activated right before he goes to sleep. Yeah. He didn't even realize that. He didn't have that awareness.
Yeah. So I'd love to talk about this a bit more. This question, what are you taking in? And the bound state. And I come back to this word of imprints that you elaborate on extensively in the book in many different ways. And maybe we could take a few minutes and explore this a little bit. There's, you know, one or two examples of imprints that lead to a bound state. And then maybe what it might take to let go of some of those things to find more sovereignty.
Sure. So what are imprints? I mean, imprints is basically anything that you've taken in through your mind that's made an impression. What binds us is the negative ones. So in that chapter, I start off by talking about my friend Star, she's an African-American executive lawyer who was working for the government, but she felt and knew that she wanted to do more. She wanted to push the boundaries and she had more potential than what she was currently doing. And she was telling me she felt bound by this fear that as an African-American woman, she shouldn't push the envelope. She would get bashed down if she were to try to do more than she deserved or whatever. I am paraphrasing what she was saying, but she basically felt stuck in this fear that was holding her back. And yet she wanted to grow past it and she deserved to. I mean, she's absolutely incredible. And then she said, you got to stare that thing down. You got to stare that belief down because it is not true. She knew it was not true. And she did. And she decided not to buy into that anymore. And then she got this really high, incredible job right after that. She decided to, you know, really not let that imprint govern her. Now, the thing is that in some cases, imprints are due to trauma, which it was in part for her too, obviously. And any trauma that any of us have can lead to an imprint that makes us feel like we can't move forward. For example, some of the veterans that I've worked with in our studies, you know, I remember one would say, you know, I'm standing in front of the mall. I know there's nothing, no danger in the mall, but I can't walk into the mall. So he knew there was nothing wrong in the mall, but somehow that imprint was so deep that he had a hard time going into a crowded place. So there's a couple of ways to do it. First, like stars, that just really becoming aware of your imprints. And I think for that, you know, there are many ways that you can become aware of your imprints. One is meditation practice, increasing that self-awareness. But another would be even in your relationships, your imprints are going to come out in your relationships really strong. You know, whatever really triggers you or pushes your buttons in a relationship and you think it's the other person, maybe it's the other person, but they're just really good at pushing that button and the button is yours, right? So, I mean, I'm not talking about abusive situations, but in general. And so what is that button, right? If you feel like people don't respect you and in a relationship, you constantly feel like they're not respecting you. Well, that may be true or not, but either way, you got to address if that's your trigger, that's an imprint, perhaps a memory of something that happened to you once, whatever it came from, being able to see it for what it is allows you to then start to free yourself from it. And then trauma imprints, you know, do need oftentimes more work. And that's why the research we've done with breathing with veterans, we really saw that. So a lot of them, like the guy standing in front of the mall, his mind knows there's nothing wrong. There's no danger there, but his body is still, you know, like that book, The Body Keeps the Score. His body was still believing in that traumatic experience. And so I share, you know, one of the veterans in our study, we were walking down the road and he approached a bridge. We were approaching a bridge and he started sweating. And I said, what's going on? And that was his trauma. He had had a combat trauma surrounding a bridge in Iraq. And so in those trauma situations, you know, doing some work around that can help. Like the breathing that we did in the studies that we ran studies using sky breath meditation, which is like a 20-30 minute breathing protocol that the veterans trained in for about a week. And after that, their anxiety normalized, their post-traumatic stress, some of them no longer qualified as having it at all. And we could see even physiologically that they were no longer responding to startles in the same way they were normalizing. And that work sometimes does need to happen in order for those imprints to loosen their power over you.
Well, one thing I appreciated, and these are my words, not yours, so correct anything that's wrong here, but I think I'm reminded of a professor who came to speak to us in graduate school. His name is Ed Diener. And you probably know that name very well. And I remember him saying, you know, if you're going to have courage, you better have wisdom. And I think, you know, what you're talking about in particular, sometimes, not always, but sometimes if we're like started staring our imprints in the face, our beliefs in the face, and just looking at very clearly at these things, it can take a lot of courage. It can be really difficult, can be really activating, whether it's from a traumatic event we've been through or something else. And if we're going to do that, doing that wisely, doing that skillfully, if we can have a guide who's really trained in that, great. I love too, in the book, just on this note, you mentioned how when you were experiencing, looking, I think, at some of your own imprints, if you used a certain practice, mindfulness, anxiety would rise, panic would arise, and it would be there and it would be kind of debilitating. But if you did another practice, the sky breath practice, it was super supportive in a moment. So I think there's this piece about wisdom when we're being courageous, discernment, and looking at how do we approach this skillfully versus just diving headfirst right into the deep end of the pool. So anything you'd like to elaborate on around that?
Yes. And I mean, that's why I start the book with a chapter on our relationship with ourself, because I feel like that's the groundwork. You know, I was talking earlier about how many people have this sort of toxic relationship with themselves and how it's essential to develop a strong, kind, compassionate relationship with yourself in order for you to then take that's the first step of sovereignty, to then be able to go deeper and then clear your mind, develop a sovereign mind, develop sovereign emotions, develop sovereign relationships, you know, accessing your intuition and so forth. So I think that's really critical. And then, the wisdom is essential, and finding a practice that works for you. For me, mindfulness, because I was in such a high state of anxiety after living through 9/11 in New York City, I was just becoming super aware of my anxiety, and that was not helpful. It was panic inducing. Whereas the breathing practice that reconditioned my nervous system, the sky breath meditation reconditioned my nervous system to be calmer from the inside out in a way, you know, calming the nervous system, calming the trauma, or helping heal the trauma, and then calming the mind as a consequence. That was really powerful and why I ended up researching it with veterans with trauma. And the wisdom piece, yes, because, you know, these imprints that we're taking in all the time, either through trauma that happened to us or through just all the media that we're taking in, you know, over 60,000 gigabytes of information every day across all our media channels, which is enough to crash a small computer in a week. I mean, you just think about it. It's just insane.
Insane.
And yeah, we're taking all that in. And then what if that is quality? Like, what if that is deeply nourishing to your mind and soul? What if that enlivens your heart and makes your life better, you know? And so that's the invitation, is not just how do we clear our mind and see our imprints, but it's also what are we nourishing our minds with? So bringing in the wisdom piece. And I think that's so fascinating in our society. You know, we glorify the famous and the beautiful and the powerful and the wealthy. Who cares? Like, do these people have anything valuable to share with us? And the wise people, do we glorify them? We don't even know who they are, where to find them. And yet there's a treasure trove of wisdom across all cultures, philosophies, religions, that's ancient, and that we, in every country, there's a treasure trove of wisdom out there. And I think it's time that we start to glamorize that, because at the end of our life, how will we want to have lived, you know, spending all of our life looking at handbags on Instagram, or having conditioned our mind with wisdom that has helped us to live the life we actually wanted to live and to sail through it in the difficult times and to be present with the beautiful moments in our life, like the ones you spend with your child in your backyard.
I think that ties so deeply into this next part where I'd love to go with you for kind of our final pieces of our time together. And again, if you'll indulge me, I highlighted another passage from your book. So I was so struck that towards the end of your book, you had a whole chapter about intuition. There's so many reasons I love that. Maybe it's part of the reason is it's where I'm at in my own development and getting more curious about that and listening to my life and my heart and what does that mean. But I've had some people on the show who have talked more about this, and it's just such a beautiful piece of the book that you included. So I wanted to pull out a poem, because you have poetry in your book as well, which I also loved, and to share this, and we can use this as a lead into this idea again that we've been coming back to of reclaiming, coming home, following what is true for us in our heart. You used the word soul, you know, a few moments ago. So coming into that idea as we close out the conversation. So you write, "They made you feel you would die if you did not obey, if you did not abide. Little did they know that because you listened not to them, but to your heart, you came alive. Silence the mind, for it is only in that silence, that stillness, that you can hear the music of your heart." I'd invite you to share anything you'd like to, kind of building on what we've been talking about, that are along these lines of getting quiet, becoming aware, letting go of imprints that don't serve us in order to follow our heart. And this piece about following the heart being an important part of finding more sovereignty or living a sovereign life.
Thank you, Josh. That was beautifully read. You know, I was just talking about the research on, you know, when we're most creative. And there's, you know, also research showing that when things are challenging and the decision is complicated, if you go with your gut feeling, you're going to make a better decision. So that's, again, the neuroscience, and that's all well and good. But it's interesting that there's science about this, because we have been taught the opposite, right? We've been taught, think before you act, look before you jump, reason, rationality, and logic, which are wonderful. I mean, who doesn't like that? I mean, everybody.
Sure.
It's a great tool. It's necessary. And yet, we've been taught intuition, gut feelings, it's magical thinking, push it aside. What the heck is that? You know, that's crazy talk. And yet we know from research, it's an instinct. I opened the chapter with the story of my friend Kushal, who walked into one of the Twin Towers on 9/11. And the guard said, "Everyone stay in the building." And his gut told him to run. And he saved his life by a hair because he listened to his intuition. You know, how often have we received an intuition and not listened? And later on, if we thought about it, we knew better, you know? Mm-hmm. And there's many different forms of intuition. You know, you could think of it as a physiological process, a cognitive process. There are different ways that scientists think about it. But the fact of the matter is that it's there and it's something that can be honed and taken into account rather than discounted. You know, in our society, I think it's complete discount. And when I talked to my colleague, Joseph Michaels, who does research on intuition decision-making, and he said, no, when I try to make a decision, I consult, you know, logically and reasonably, but I consult my intuition. I consult my gut feeling. I think that's a really great approach. It's like, let's make room for both because it's a cognitive skill that exists that we haven't made room for much in our society and that is still being researched, but it is there. I'll share a story of, you know, one of the remarkable sovereign individuals I've had the opportunity to meet. This is a woman, her name is Lynn Tilton, and I was meant to escort her to a stage at Stanford. She was coming to give a talk and I hadn't given it much thought. And I'm sitting at this cafe waiting for her. And then she comes and she sits next to me. And within 20 or 30 seconds, I start crying. Mm. And she looks at me and she's like, you're crying. I'm making you cry. And I'm thinking, what is happening to me? I'm her host. What is, but what's interesting with me is that my intuitions have sometimes come to me like that as an emotion that I don't always understand. But I came to understand what it meant just a few seconds later. I had never in my life met such a sovereign woman in my life. And what she was emanating was creating this, I think, this recognition of the fact that myself, this was me also 15 years ago, myself and this longing to be, to have that sovereignty, but not just for myself, but for all women on the planet. And I had this flash. It was just a flash of insight that if everyone had this, it would be a very different, much healthier planet. So that was just like this in an instant kind of an awareness. Anyway, she's an amazing woman. And she herself has a really interesting story. So most of her family died in the Holocaust. Her parents and her were living in New York when she was a teenager. And then her father passed away and he was the main income provider. And it was kind of hard living, but she got herself into Yale on a tennis scholarship and then got pregnant, you know, married at Yale, got pregnant shortly thereafter, and then was a single mom, you know, who had to care for her child. So she joined Wall Street in the 80s as a woman, where she was sexually harassed by both colleagues and clients constantly. And then at age 30, she decided, okay, to hell with that. I'm retiring now. I've got enough money. I'm retiring to Florida. And she retired to Florida, but just then she had an intuition that came to her in the form of a dream where she felt her father coming to her and saying, this is not what I had in mind for you. And she realized there was something else that she was meant to do. And that was, she had that intention to help families not lose their main breadwinners. And so she went and bought companies that had been abandoned as lost causes by all the consulting companies and everything. And she would buy those companies to make sure that those employees would not lose their job. And she would turn them around. She's called the turnaround queen. One example is Styla Makeup, which is now a big company. At one point, she had 700,000 employees. It was the CEO of many different companies. And she's done amazingly well. And she followed that intuition. And I asked her the other day, you know, I interviewed her for the book, and she said, there's room for logic and reason, but you know, you have to follow your intuition. Yeah. So it's just one example. Now, recently I saw a statistic that 85% of CEOs follow their intuition.
That's fascinating. I'm reminded of a recent guest named Dr. Lisa Miller. You might know that name.
Yes.
Yeah. And she talks about these two modes of awareness, just really kind of simplifying because we just have a few minutes left here, but this achieving awareness, which is more of the, what do I want and how do I get it? You know, this kind of achievement drive orientation that we have, and that can be a way to organize my life. And then this awakened awareness, which is really about listening to your life. What is life revealing to me now? What is my life telling me and opening to the messages and receiving? And there just seems so much alignment. And I love what you're saying. You keep kind of coming back to this point that it's not either or, it's both. When done well, it's both, right? And that's what she says too, is we need both. But so often the awakened awareness, or using your words here, intuition, is underdeveloped, or we've lost touch with it because of a society that might value the achievement orientation so much more. So it can kind of get conditioned out of us or quieted. And coming back to your word again, reclaiming, coming back to it, you know? Yes. So
listening, listening. Absolutely. It reminds me of a, you know, this talk that I heard this Buddhist teacher from, I think he was from Cambodia, and he would say, in Cambodia, we say meditation is listening to the grass grow, which is so interesting. But yeah, listening and our capacity for listening, we have to make conscious effort for it now with meditation, because there is so much input coming at us. And there are fewer and fewer moments in our lives where we can be in a listening place because of the distraction that's out there. The more we make room for that, the more we can listen to our inner voice. And the moment we make room for it, we will hear it. You know, it becomes something that becomes more and more automatic the more you train yourself. You know, I'll share one more thing, is that in India, there's a program called the Intuition Process that's been developed for children. And I've seen myself just how children can learn to access this very quickly, because they haven't unlearned it yet.
Right.
And it's remarkable. It's remarkable to see that this is a cognitive faculty we were all born with.
Can you tell me about something you've seen from that program?
So I heard about this program because it's offered through Art of Living, which is the organization that I do meditation with. So I signed my child up because I thought, great, you know, this is for kids. So I signed him up. And at one point they have you come into the room and you can not interact, but you can walk around, and the kids are blindfolded doing an exercise and you watch them. And I walk in and there's this 5-year-old, and his job is there's a bear with color that's colored in, and there's a bear that's not colored in. And he's blindfolded and he's choosing colors, and he's meant to color in this bear that's not colored in. This 5-year-old is choosing the exact colors, and he is coloring into the corners of the ears. I mean, just like as if his eyes were open, better than if his eyes were open, because I don't know how well a 5-year-old always could color. And I had, again, one of those moments where I just had tears coming, because the potential that lies within each human being. We don't even know all the things that our brain is wired for. The ability to see beyond what we think we can see. And I think the most moving example is the schools in India where they're using this with blind children. And you see these blind children reading books with their fingers, but it's not braille writing. It's just, they're just able to read. They're able to see colors. They're able to gain sovereignty over their lives by seeing without their eyes. I mean, I think usually we would think this is crazy stuff. This doesn't exist, but I've seen it with my own eyes, and it just shows the brain has so much potential. We don't even know about it because we haven't learned it, or we've dismissed it. And actually a colleague and I are looking into doing research on this specific program, this intuition program.
Emma, I love it. I also was so struck by your humility. I mean, you went to Yale, you teach at Yale, you work with, you know, some of the leaders of the top organizations in the country and the world. And yet, you know, you're talking about things we don't know. And I love in the book you highlighted around this too, one of the top neuroscientists who is just basically saying how little we know about how the brain actually works. Like, we really don't know much. I love the humility that's there. Thank you so much for your work. I'm curious if there's anything from this conversation that you'd like to underscore, maybe something you've already shared, or something new, just as a closing thought around this idea of reclaiming our freedom, you know, our energy, our personal power in a way that leads to sovereignty.
Thank you, Josh. What I share also in the classes that I teach is just question things. Question why the self-loathing? That doesn't make any sense. Question, one example is I got to interview this colonel in the army, and his job was to develop messaging for the Taliban to trick the Taliban to think certain things. Basically trying to develop imprints to place into the Taliban leaders' minds, right? And so I said, so how do you interact with the world and messaging that comes your way? And he says, I see through it, you know? And he was telling me about how with his kid, when he's in the supermarket and the child is like, wants some unhealthy cereal. And he says, oh, well, why do you want that box? And the child will be like, oh, because it looks so fun and cute. And then he'll be like, okay, well, why do you think it looks like that? And like, oh, it's just so colorful and it's like playful and there's a game on the back. And so why do you think it's like that? Why do you think they designed it like that? Oh, because it would be so fun. And then I want to eat it. And like, yeah. So why do you think, you know, and the kid's like, oh, because kids will like it. They'll, you know, training them to question, to see through. And again, this is not about like anger at the man or anything like that. It's just to live a sovereign life. We need to open our eyes. You know, we need to open our eyes and we need to quiet our mind. And as we open our eyes and quiet our mind, we build awareness. I feel like just looking at the world like a child, you know, with questioning and also with awareness, building it with meditation or any kind of contemplative practice, and harking for the messages that are within.
Thank you, Emma. It is such a joy to sit with you. This book is tremendous. I'd recommend for people to go out and pick it up. If people want to follow you, your work, what you're doing, pick up the book, where are the best places for them to do that?
So I have a website for the book called iamsov.com, where I've put some extra tools and so forth on there for readers. And then I do have social media, even though I have a sovereign relationship with it, but I do have it because it is helpful for people to get extra, you know, extra tidbits and stuff. So on Instagram, Facebook.
Fantastic. Thank you so much again for being here.
Thank you, Josh.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Courageous Life. I'd like to extend special thanks, as always, to my executive producer, Matthew Patrick Donner, for all of the incredible behind-the-scenes work he does to make this show sound great. He's also responsible for composing the original music that you hear at the beginning and the end of every episode. Also, if you're enjoying the show and the conversation, please do share with friends, because I believe that courage is contagious. And while you're at it, if you happen to be on iTunes, make sure you click the subscribe button, or if you feel so compelled, leave a positive review. It encourages me to keep going and also helps others to find a valuable show amidst the many podcasts that are out there. Until next time, this is Joshua Steinfeld with The Courageous Life.